And one time I played a dwarf in 3.5 who had a 4 charisma, which was so much fun because he just owned that ugly.
Live from the Mundangerous Skating Rink in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 22 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're opening up our mailbag and answering your questions. But first, the Morning Glory campaign gets the message quiet and clear. And later, we'll share our favorite character builds in the Character Creation Forge.
So last week in the Morning Glory campaign, we talked about how we had fought Nistrum Shadar when we were imprisoned, and then he had defeated us. And once we had gotten out, we decided to continue investigating. That led us into an underground facility in which we basically found a battery powered by demon-bound shards. What we didn't mention was, how did that investigation come about? Well, we wake up the next morning and we figure, that guy who just beat the crap out of us didn't kill us, so maybe he's not such a bad guy after all.
Yeah, you guys always had so much faith in Nistrum.
No matter how many times he betrayed us.
Yeah. Thanks to Aaron DeCaneth, you were no longer wanted in the city. The city watch was still observing you, but you were allowed to move freely. You went to the palace where Nistrum was staying, found his room, and didn't get an answer at the door, so you guys broke in.
Very, very quietly, as it turned out.
Yeah.
Because a silent spell went off.
And then a fireball.
Yeah. So
a very quiet fireball.
We got wrecked by Nistrum twice in 2 days.
It was really like only 8 hours between them. So
yeah. Approximately one long rest worth.
Right. So the entire room is wrecked, right? From due to the pressure wave and of course the flames as well. But Bahar notices that a panel in one of the walls is also destroyed, revealing a secret room. And inside there, there are undamaged papers, including schematics showing a large labyrinth underneath the Canna facility. And so, of course, you guys say, maybe we should check this out. It's very important. But let's not tell Aaron DeCaneth or Primus.
Yeah. Well, in hindsight, that seems like just a much smarter idea than what we did.
I mean, you didn't necessarily know who was a good guy and who was a bad guy at this point. I mean, Primus actually killed one of you.
That's true. So this is one of those weird time travel things, right? Where I think we knew that Nistrum had been aggressive towards us in our timeline, but we thought maybe that was because we were so mean to him back around the Day of Mourning, and we had caused our own plight or created our own enemy. And so
Could have been very possible.
Yeah, we kept giving him the benefit of the doubt to no positive effect. So yeah, so then we checked out the labyrinth, broke in, dealt with the demons that were guarding certain passages.
Closed the portal to the Plane of Eternal War.
Right.
And saw the huge battery of shardbound fiends and shardbound celestials.
Yeah, so just the wall of Matrix-style Kyber and Sybaris shards.
Right, and you guys said, this is probably what causes the Day of Mourning.
So, there's that. Let's find out how it all went down next week.
All right, so let's hop right into the mailbag because we've got a lot of really interesting questions.
So first up is a question from Jeffrey. He asks, what should I do with a character that I roll a 6 or a 7 as an ability score? How should I compensate for that in my character, and can I still make whatever character I want?
Well, it's not a problem if you use point buy.
Okay, yeah, but not everyone can use point buy.
It's true.
In fact, there's a good argument against point buy, at least in the sense that there's a good argument for rolling, which is that you don't have to have an idea when you go into it. You can let the dice sort of help inform your character concept.
Then what happens if the dice inform
a 6 or a 7?
No, very different people with very different stat spreads.
I mean,
and in a game with bounded accuracy like 5e, that causes big problems down the line.
Whatever, you live with it. You don't have to win every roll.
Don't do it. Don't do it because that's like 3 years of your life with a with a, an impaired character. It's however,
perfectly fine.
Don't do it.
If you roll a low score, it is perfectly fine. You just role play it. It's not that hard.
An individual character is not a problem. When everybody's doing it and one person rolls 14s and above and someone else has a 6, then it becomes an issue. However, with that 6, there are a lot of different things you can do. And it can be fun to have a low score or two. Just if you're new to the game, don't put it in constitution or dexterity, because that's going to actually probably hurt the longevity of your character. You can do it if you sort of really know what you're doing and know what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah, and then the other thing is don't put it in your main stat for the character. That's where you run into real problems, right? Like a wizard who has a 6 or a 7 in strength, you'll probably never even notice. A wizard who has a 6 or a 7 in intelligence is unplayable.
Right, and if you think about it in terms of in-game, that person would never have been able to become a wizard in the first place.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have been smart enough to ever cast their first spell.
Exactly.
They don't have the gift.
Right.
Yeah. Now, a wizard with a 6 or 7 in wisdom, I think, is sort of like that sweet spot of fun where it can get you into trouble and it's interesting to role play. It doesn't necessarily hamper you, but there are times where it would be much better if our wizard was way more insightful, but he's sort of an absent-minded professor.
You won't be good at noticing things, but you'll still be good at casting things.
Right, but for example, the low strength doesn't really hinder you. Like I would say, I always build wizards with low strength.
Yeah, and then the other thing I would say is, use that low characteristic as your defining characteristic, especially if it's a mental characteristic that you're using. Don't carry it to the extreme on charisma where you're actively foiling people attempting to have conversations mm-hmm. because you're low charisma. But if you're put in a place where the party's relying on you to make a charisma check, you know, to make a persuasion or whatever, role play it poorly. Be uncouth. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's the party's fault for putting you in that position.
I rolled a 23 intelligence in Dark Heresy, which is all very nearly the lowest you can possibly roll.
Yes.
And I got us into a lot of trouble.
You did. So the quick summary. Don't put it in your main stat. Mm-hmm. Play it up as a defining trait. And if you're not experienced in 5e, skip putting it in con or dex. Just in general, it makes you a weaker character. It's going to be harder to survive.
Yeah. So Jeff has another question. He says, I'm creating a half-orc fighter barbarian who was a slave his whole life until a recent escape. I can't figure out which background I should choose that works with that story. He fought and won drinking games to survive, so my first impulse was soldier.
All right. I know you're going to say that we should just make a custom background called escape slave or whatever. Pick whatever you want and then steal the trait from something else, right?
Right. I think which background should I pick? Really, the question is which background feature should I pick?
Right.
Yeah.
Which is fine. You should absolutely do that if you want to. But I would say if you want to pick from one of the existing ones in the PHB, I would recommend Outlander, Folk Hero, or Criminal. So if you're an Outlander, that's probably just a general good. I grew up outside of civil society, right? I live off the land. I'm not familiar with what's going on in the cities. If you've escaped from slavery, you're probably not able to go into places with large populations. You're not able to go into villages and towns. Folk Hero, on the other hand, if you're an escaped slave, people probably know your name. Slaves everywhere know that you're the slave who escaped. So you could get that folk hero benefit from other slaves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, hey, go incite a revolution.
Criminal is also really good because, of course, once you're escaped, you know, how do you make a living?
Yeah, Aladdin.
Yeah.
You're stealing bread to survive.
And, of course, Jeff, your initial idea of soldier is also great because another great way to make money is as a sellsword.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is if you're an escaped slave, the only place you can go where you know no one asks questions, into the king's army.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Always looking for a few good men.
Right, exactly. Especially if you're playing in a more like Renaissance era campaign as well. That's pretty much what you did if you were a criminal, a slave, anything like that. You enlisted in the army because no one would touch you then.
Yeah, sometimes that was your option instead of going into slavery or jail.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess you want to join the army, huh?
Right. I mean, England beat back Napoleon with that whole army.
That's right. Called conscripts for a reason.
Exactly.
Basically convicts, same thing.
Right.
The one other thing I would mention, maybe this is too many options for you, so sorry, but I sort of like a slightly reflavored hermit because I really like that whole epiphany idea. So, you know, you a slave, and it gives you a lot of time alone and to think, quite honestly.
I mean, if there's one positive, I guess that's the positive spin. But yeah, that fits in as well with the kind of Outlander idea too, right? That you can't go to society because you are branded a slave. If you were to return, you would be sent right back to slavery.
Right. And, you know, it also sort of depends on what exactly happened between slavery and the beginning of the campaign. He may have just escaped from slavery, or, you know, maybe there's a few years in there where they do something else.
Yeah. In his case, he said that...
Drinking games.
Right. That years of drinking games to survive seems probably a stretch. So maybe a little more recent. All right. Our next question comes from Raymond. Coming from 3.5 and Pathfinder, one thing that has made my group and myself, frankly, feel pretty uncomfortable with just jumping into 5e is the sheer number of changes made to spells. He notes, I can't grease this weapon anymore. While I think this is probably for the best in terms of balance, it is a hard thing to grasp, no pun intended. Was it a difficult sell for you guys to jump into 5e? What would you recommend as a strategy for a GM to try to get a new group on board with trying 5e? One-shots, adventure paths, etc.
So spells in 3.5 were basically just this crazy free-for-all. So when 4th edition rolled around, I was actually pretty happy to see the field of vision narrowed. Eventually, though, you know, it did feel pretty restrictive. So when 5th edition came around, I was happy to see things opening up a bit. But I'm happy to see that spells in 5e are better defined. So I say that as a player who would spend days browsing the 3.5 spell compendium looking for the perfect spell. And one of the first things I ever did as a player in AD&D 20 years ago was use Grease on a Dragon's Eyes and then cast Agitate, which I convinced the DM that that would make the grease light on fire. So that was super cool the first time, but the GM shut it down rightfully when I tried to do it every single combat.
Yeah, and I think overall, spells still work mostly familiar enough that if you know what they did previously, you'll know generally how they work in 5e, and you'll obviously have to look up specific mechanics, but they generally have the same uses. There are a couple spells that are a little weird now. Mm-hmm. You know, in general, things are better defined, but then there are some spells like reverse gravity, which is just throwing a wrench. You know, like, okay, we reverse gravity. Now what? I fly down?
I mean, it was always a mess.
Right, yeah. And so it's iconic, right? I mean, it's one of those spells that some wizard players love to take. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't make any more sense now than it did before. I don't know if that's better or worse. It just is.
Right. And then, you know, some spells have been changed to their detriment. Time Stop is basically worthless.
Time Stop is terrible.
Yeah.
Haste has much more of a cost now.
Well, it doesn't age you a year anymore.
Well, true, but it's much riskier, right?
Yes, because in combat.
In combat, yeah, because of the concentration mechanic, it's easier to lose control of haste.
But I like that because it used to be this RP setback, right? Oh, I aged a year, but there was no drawback in combat. There was no reason not to have it.
Yeah.
If you could figure out someone to de-age yourself later or, you know, a one shot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in haste, you become fatigued for a round, right?
Or, once it wears off, yeah.
Yeah.
Not actually fatigue, but basically.
Right,
you can't do anything for a round. As a player in 5e, I like that many of my spells are simplified just because it's too difficult to remember what everything does when you have too many different options and like how all of it interacts. You know, in 3.5, changing your sheets on the fly when things wore off or, you know, lasted this certain number of rounds and overlapped, it bogged everything down. It was so complicated and difficult.
Yeah, there's also, you want to keep in mind, some spells scale. So you can use certain spells, you can cast them at a higher level slot, and then they get additional effects. That scaling is all over the place. Sometimes it's really good to scale. Sometimes it's super wasteful to scale a spell. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of got to pay it. It's not as cut and dry as, oh, this spell scales. It's more valuable. Sometimes the scaling is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And then cantrips are suddenly very useful in 5e.
So really, so good. They're great to put even on a character that isn't really a spellcaster.
Yeah, which is a big change because your party is no longer resting when the wizard is out of spells, which is sort of the old 3.5 trope, right? The 10-minute workday.
Mm-hmm. It makes me wonder why we don't use more high elf in the forge, honestly. Free cantrip, plus two dex.
Eh.
You don't like elves.
Well, I just think if you're not a spellcaster, you've probably got better things to do with your action than even a scaled cantrip, right? What's nice about it is a wizard used to have to carry around a crossbow. Mm-hmm. And now you just have a cantrip. So I'm just still doing magic. It's just my firebolt or my ray of frost.
It's pretty cool. Get your players on board with that.
Yeah, if the spell list doesn't convince them, how would you recommend introducing a new group to 5e?
Run a game.
Yeah, I really like the Lost Mine of Phandelver, especially if you're an experienced role player. The knock on that adventure, it's the one that comes in the starter box, so it's somewhere between $10 and $20 to pick up. The knock on it is that the first encounter is extremely deadly, especially if you're not an experienced player. I think it's fine for experienced players. It's kind of a welcome to 5e moment.
Right. If you're not an experienced DM, maybe pull your punches a bit just on that first encounter.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound like that's a problem for them. So I think that's a good one. By the end of the first dungeon, you should have the swing of 5e combat and understand if it's what you like or not what you like.
Raymond also asks, what do you think of the Diviner Wizard? Has anyone played it? It's hard to tell if his archetype ability will be really strong or a waste.
So the archetype ability that we're talking about is Portent, which you get at second level when you choose Divination. Basically, at the end of a long rest, you roll 2d20s, you record those numbers, and then you can substitute those numbers for any roll that a creature you can see makes.
Or you make.
Or you, yeah, because you're a creature you can see.
Right. You've got to do it before the roll, so no like taking away a critical hit, but this is so versatile.
Yeah, you can guarantee guarantee is a bit of a stretch, but you can pretty well figure out what the result of any roll that's going to be made will be right. Before it happens.
You can very nearly guarantee an outcome that you will like, right? Because, of course, if the die is high, you use it on you or your allies.
And if it's low, you use it on your enemies.
And if it's right in the middle, there's probably a good chance that, you know if like an 8 will succeed anyway, because you have a good chance of succeeding. You just need to not roll low.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you gamble.
Yeah, that too.
It's not terrible. You know, that 10 could still be fun.
Think of it this way. In 4th edition, there was an item that did this same thing, the Dice of Auspicious Fortune, except it was 3 times a day, and you could only use it on yourself, and I took it on every single character. It's that good a power.
So that's the question. Is it really strong? Because I don't think it's a waste, right? I think it's perfectly usable, but its effectiveness is so...
Here's the thing. It's a clutch power. When you need something to happen or you need it to not happen, it does. Think how often we're like, hey, lucky. We should take lucky.
That's a good point. It's very much like the lucky feat where it's when you need it, it's nice to have it.
Right. If you never use your portent rolls, great. You had a good day.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, of course, at level 14, you get 3 of them, which is even better.
Yeah, and you get a really cool ability at level 6, the expert divination. It basically lets you cast divination spells up to 5th level, or from 2nd to 5th level, for free. Because as soon as you cast one, you regain a spell slot of equal or lesser value.
Right. It's pretty easy to overlook. And, of course, keep in mind, you're not just going to keep casting augury over and over again, because most divination spells, subsequent castings increase the chance of a false reading.
Yeah, and then there's also material cost, too.
Right, but it's really nice to just to be able to be like, I don't know. Let me check the future quickly and let's see.
Yeah, like I'm the diviner, so let me just go scry for a bit. Mm-hmm. But I'm not spending my combat resources to do it.
Right.
I'm still a fully functioning wizard.
And like we talked about in the investigation episode, the school of wizardry that you pick doesn't limit your spell selection. So you can still take all of those crazy combat spells if you really want.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as has anyone played it, I don't think either of us have played a divination wizard. I did play in a game with a divination wizard, and it was quite handy.
I gave the portent ability as part of the epic destinies that I put together for you guys. I gave it to Bahar, who became a Madani prophet.
Oh, right.
And he used it all the time.
Yeah, actually, I remember using that every session. There was always some moment where it was like, okay, well, we're just going to take a 15 on that.
Right. Or he would keep offering it, right? Like,
right.
Just remember, I've got an 18 sometime today.
Right, right. All right, so our next question comes from GrogSD on Twitter. Loot, how do you handle it? I noticed when talking about your previous campaign, Morning Glory, that your characters have a lot of high-level magic items and piles of gold. How did you go about distributing it? Did you use random loot tables, player choice?
So one thing that you should note when you're listening to the Morning Glory recap is that at this point in the story, the characters are right around level 13. According to the DMG, any 13th level characters are going to have piles of magic items and gold, even if you use random loot. At lower levels, they were getting things like, you know, a barrel full of 30 spears. So it was like, hey,
thanks, Dad. Right?
You could sell all these for half price, sure, back in town. Yeah, good luck getting it there.
Yeah, we also got socks for Christmas. It was terrible.
I did steal one of their mules. Well, kobolds did. So I tried many different things. Like I've said before, with Morning Glory, we were kind of kicking the tires of the system. So I wanted to try different ways to do things. So I did do random loot drops for a while. At level 7, when they killed the Steel Kraken, I randomly rolled a level 10 horde. But then, you know, players need to figure out what to do with those useless items that they get, because they're obviously going to get things that they can't use, especially if you're not just rolling magic item powers, but the base items as well. You know, if someone uses a longsword and you get a magic pole arm, well, maybe they try to use it, and some people like that, but sometimes they just can't use it. You know, they're not capable of using the shield because they don't have that proficiency, right, or something like that.
Right, or their great weapon fighter gets a shield. It's like, all right, well, I've wasted either my loot or my ability.
Right, exactly. So if you've got a magic mart somewhere in your game, then players can trade or sell those items. But I've noticed that people who like to use random loot drops don't usually like magic marts in their game. So you need to give somewhere. You could have players pick their items, but I find that that's less fun for everyone. That was sort of standard in 4E, and that was one of the, I think, justified complaints. I prefer to pick useful items for my players and then customize them. So our magic item episode, episode number 4, if you download the PDF that has the custom end game items that I made for the party, although those are like legendary level. But, you know, incorporate those magic items as a story reward or let players direct it. Like when they were infiltrating the Kanith facility beneath Sharn, there was a vial that said, in case of fire elemental escape, you know, break. So I let them decide who's going to take it and what they were going to apply it to. And what they happened to apply it to was Bahar's short sword, which turned it into a frostbrand. But I would have done that if they had done it on a quarterstaff or something along those lines, or if they had applied it to a robe, then that would have, you know, done fire resistance, and I would have, you know, come up with something more interesting, maybe like probably +1 or +2 armor bonus.
Sure.
Yeah. And then in terms of distribution, evenly split the loot.
Yeah, definitely. There's that trope for anyone who's ever done anything with Dragonlance, they know about the Kender, the little halfling race that likes to steal things. It's cute for about 2 sessions, and mm-hmm. then it gets extremely annoying when you've got one player who's always playing against the party. Mm-hmm. So it's much easier if it's going to be a long-term campaign to just say, okay, we're going to divide it evenly. We're going to give this to, you know, greatest utility if there's a tiebreaker. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't solve it, flip a coin, because there'll be more loot next session. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah, there should be. And even if it's a tight loot game, actually, especially if it's a tight loot game, it really needs to be fair, because you don't want to go levels with, you know, the last person who might be alive in a combat who needs to bring all of you back to consciousness. You don't want them to be poorly equipped.
Or, I mean, you don't want them incented to steal everyone's stuff and then right. say, or am I going to bring you back?
Unless you want to play that kind of game, in which case it doesn't really matter what you do with loot.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. It's gonna get distributed one way or the other.
Right.
That's how paranoia works. So that works for D&D, and I mostly agree. That's how I do it. I generally try and give targeted loot, but sometimes it's fun to just roll randomly.
I mean, that's built into the system a lot of times.
Right. Right. And that's the other type of item acquisition system that we should talk about, because games like the 40K RPGs, mm-hmm. you're rolling against some statistic in order to acquire loot.
Right. It's basically a get loot stat.
Right. There's a skill for loot finding.
Sort of like in computer RPGs, like charisma, right? Your persuade skill.
Yeah, or your luck stat in like Fallout.
Right.
Right. It determines the quality of the items that drop. So if that's the case, you've got much more difficulty in controlling what happens. Players are going to be digging through books and looking for the items and they're going to use that sort of meta knowledge to inform what they look for mm-hmm. and what they're rolling for. There comes a point when you just have to say logically, this little podunk town out here in like the western steppes where everyone is a goat herder, you're not finding that high level magic item.
Right.
You know, you're not finding that antique bolt pistol.
Right. Of course, on the flip side, you know, when they find themselves in the sector capital, you're going to need to be like, well, yep, everything's available.
Yeah. Or, I mean, maybe it's not available to you. Maybe you don't have the credentials to even try and buy it, right?
It's true. So players, if you're playing a system like that, make sure that someone in the party is spec'd for item acquisition.
Yeah, yeah, that helps. Because there's other ways to control it story-wise, right? So it's like, no, the merchants who have that aren't willing to talk to you. You look like cops, mm-hmm. right? That sort of thing. Or you don't have enough rep to even go to them. They wouldn't believe that you have the resources to even pay them.
Mm-hmm. So at high levels in 5th edition, players have so many magic items and there are so many magic item options that I sort of took the you guys handled it approach where I basically made it so nearly everything was available and it was up to them to decide what they had on them at any given time because they had sort of a way station where they could swap things out. And in that instance, the attunement slots in 5e really helped because, you know, very powerful items, you were limited to 3 anyway.
So. Right, right. Yeah, and that's the other thing to keep in mind with 5e is that we've talked about in the magic item episode that the rarity system isn't perfectly balanced.
Or really at all balanced?
It's broad strokes, it's okay. But keep in mind the rarity that you should be giving based on the level of the party. So when you're at level 5, they shouldn't have multiple rare items, right?
Right.
When you get to level 20, you should have very rare or legendary items.
Well, actually, supposedly, bounded accuracy takes into account no magic items. So magic items are just bonuses, so you could be okay with none of them.
Do you believe that?
Not really.
It's a lie.
I mean, the Tarrasque has plus 19 to hit.
And it also has immunity to non-magical weapons, damage. Right. So,
well, you better be a monk.
Yeah, right? So you have to have something by then. The system still works if you give like a legendary and a couple very rares to a 20th level character. You just have to kind of step it in as to how many items they're having based on which tier of the game they're at.
Right. I will say any game that involves PCs who are humanoids reaches a certain point where it doesn't matter how many more magic items you give them because they only have so many hands or body parts on which to wear them.
Yeah.
So once you're fully kitted out, unless you find something that's better than what you already have, players are just going to ignore it. It doesn't matter if you're swimming in a pile of magic items like Scrooge McDuck. It's useless to them.
Right. Dagger of common speech.
You use that. Plus one dagger of common speech.
And then there is one other type of system in which loot can be very important. And this you want to very carefully manage. And that is if items impact character advancement.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking specifically of Warhammer Fantasy 2nd mm-hmm. Edition, which has a great story attached to it from our group with one of our players stealing a noble's clothes and leaping out of the third story of his house.
Because he needed 4 fine quality pairs of clothes in order to advance as a noble.
Exactly. So to advance his character, he needed the items, and so he nearly killed himself trying to steal them. So in those cases, right, you want to keep an eye on it, and that way you can help the characters advance as you want them to.
Right. Our next question is from Petter. What is the strangest check that you have ever had a player roll?
I had a player roll bluff. I am a horse.
Wait, was he a horse?
He was not a horse.
Was he equine in any way?
Not even a little bit.
Did he make it?
Yeah. Yeah. So that kind of became the joke. So this is in college, and in college I barely played role-playing games. And when I did, I played them via IRC. So it was text chat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So the player wanted to bluff a guard and avoid being noticed or whatever, right? I asked, what are you telling him? And he wasn't able to come up with a good story. And somebody else goes, just tell him you're a horse. So he goes, bluff, I am a horse. All right, roll it. 20. All right. I mean, he doesn't believe you're a horse, but he doesn't think you're a threat, right? I mean, he thinks you're a crazy person, but not a harmful one.
Oh, horse. I heard something slightly different.
Yeah, yeah.
But I totally believed you.
Right, right. So that was our kind of running joke in that game was, well, I bluff, I'm a horse. It worked once.
So I, honestly, I'm a little bit ashamed to tell this story, but in my early days as a GM, I was lenient, and I won't explain the context. Forget it. I used a 4E skill challenge to have a PC determine how they were giving birth to an Eldritch Horror and have the rest of the party prevent that from happening. So she was making endurance checks and they were making whatever heal was in 4E to prevent a birth.
That's...
Nobody liked that session.
No. The first issue was you attempted to force the birth of an Eldritch Horror on a PC.
No, it was their idea.
Oh my God.
I let it go. Right? I was like, yes, and roll endurance. I should have said, put that Eldritch Horror back on the wall.
Right. Well, why don't we open it up to the audience? Why don't you tweet at us at TPTcast with your strangest checks you've ever asked a player to roll? And Petter also has one more question for us. How much combat do you normally run in a campaign? Will that increase or decrease now that you'll be running a campaign where everyone plays a grappler?
I mean, obviously, it's just a sweaty grapple fest, I think. It's every session is just wall-to-wall combat with grapples.
Well, that's because we're playing WWE 5th edition now.
Okay. I don't know the sports or the fig sports, okay? But I would, I would totally do that. Maybe like a bracket. Oh, that'd be amazing. So in an actual game, and this actually goes for any RPG, not just 5e, I usually shoot for one big combat per session. It doesn't necessarily have to come in at the end. You know, sometimes you open with the combat if it was set up for. Sometimes it's just sprung on the PCs. Sometimes it's two purposefully small fights. Rarely is an entire session just one huge combat, but, you know, it definitely happens, particularly at the end of arcs. And I rarely have no fights, but sometimes it happens when the players are actively avoiding it. And, you know, I'm certainly not going to force them into a combat if they don't want to. If my players are happy with no combat at all that session, I'm cool with it too.
Yeah, I always try and plan 1 to 2 encounters that I expect to be a fight.
Mm-hmm.
If the players bypass it, great, right? That's a win for them either way. But I want to at least have those encounters prepped in case I need them. And then occasionally if things are going kind of south and the role play isn't really going in the direction I want it, or maybe I'm not doing a good job of...
You shoot them.
Yeah, somebody gets shot. A grenade gets tossed into the room and then we'll just deal with that.
You know how you deal with that?
Toss it back.
No, it explodes, and then someone dies, and then their grenades explode. It's a grenade cascade.
That's my new move.
Yeah. It's not pretty.
We've run the occasional session where we did just a true dungeon crawl, where it was moving through, you know, check for traps, open the room, fight whatever's inside, that sort of thing, within the context of a greater campaign. I think those are great, too, sometimes just to break up. Especially if you're in a heavy intrigue, heavy investigation arc,
mm-hmm.
It can be a nice change of pace, right? Like, let me just fight stuff. Let me just roll some dice and feel like I'm good at something, because it can be very vexing in a heavy role-playing campaign sometimes.
Yeah, and, you know, especially in something like D&D where every character has combat abilities, you want to be able to use them.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And in that case, the combats I run, I'll try and vary them enough tactically that, you know, this room is a flying challenge, right? This one has uneven terrain that's causing issues for them. This one has sort of environmental factors that are unpredictable.
All whatever. These creatures are made of fire and are therefore immune to it.
Right.
Enjoy that, fire sorcerer.
Yeah, that got thrown at me a lot. Do you hear that, Ishan?
I think that's you swearing because we're up against more fire elementals.
That sound can only mean one thing. It's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
Obviously, we love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne, that's malice minus meat.
You can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
And if you can't fit it into 140 characters, you can email us at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And finally, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So in the Forge, we've got our favorite builds.
And you brought two.
Yeah, yeah. Guilty.
So why don't you just go ahead and start with one, and then I'll do mine, and then you can do yours.
Okay, I appreciate that.
because like many things... Like the way your builds treat class balance, you have not followed the rules of the exercise, sir.
Two is fine. My favorite. It says our favorite builds. We have three.
All right. Who do you start with?
So I begin with the story of Solomon the Stag. Ladies and gentlemen, please settle in, because I'm about to tell you the backstory of my very favorite character of all time.
You know, I'm just going to do a hard cut right there. I'm gonna throw in like a record scratch, and then we're going to go right into it.
That's gonna hurt me, because it's a good story.
All right, tell your story.
So Solomon the Stag was a character that I played actually back in a 4E game. It was a Planescape game. And he ended up being my favorite because I played him all the way from level 1 to level 30. For those of you who know Planescape, some of this will make some sense. The rest of you, well, you should just get in on a little Planescape action. He used to be a high-level member of the Fated, the Takers. That's the faction that is basically social Darwinists, might makes right. So he was a Paladin of Tyranny, very high level, and in a tangle with the Solar, he was geshed to be a good person for the rest of his life. And of course, once he started doing good deeds because he couldn't help it, he fell. Lost all of his abilities. And that was his backstory. And this is why he was level one as a traditional paladin of good.
So we should pause here. That word gesh. Lots of people read that wrong. How do you spell that one?
G-E-A-S.
That is a spell that no one knows how to pronounce.
Yeah, because it's actually a Welsh curse.
Is it Welsh?
Gaelic.
Gaelic, something like that, yeah.
One of those.
And what's the difference?
As we're learning you about this, so, yeah. You know, close enough.
All right, so Solomon winds up back at level one because he falls for doing good things.
That's right. He used to be called Solomon the Wise because he liked to cut babies in half. But in... But in Planescape, a turncoat is called a stag, so he became Solomon the Stag. Now, he couldn't be with the Fated anymore because they didn't care about him at all because he was now powerless. So he joined the Mercy Killers as a sellsword. For those of you who don't know, the Mercy Killers, they don't kill out of mercy. They kill the concept of mercy. So he still wasn't like a nice person, but, you know, he still attempted to do good and... He also had a Mark of Storm and big heavy armor that was just dark black steel. Think of him like a fantasy Michael Weston from Burn Notice in that he was grumpy all the time. And, you know, he didn't want to help people. He had a potty mouth. But if you showed up at his door and was like, hey, I have absolutely no money and you'll probably get killed helping me, but I need assistance, he would be like, let me get my armor. And then he'd go out and help you. While swearing at you the whole time and calling you an idiot.
This sounds an awful lot like many of your NPCs.
yes, maybe. The other thing that he did as he progressed is he teleported everywhere. It got to the point, actually, where he never walked. He just teleported up to 30 feet.
That must have been disorienting for his friends.
Good.
If he had any friends.
Yeah, and he didn't really. It was so much fun to roleplay because, of course, I got to play a mean, ornery character who still never hurt the party or did anything to, you know, make things more difficult for party cohesion. He just was mean about it.
Right. He was just gruff.
Right. But if you needed him to lay on hands, of course he was going to do that. In fact, if he didn't lay on hands, then he would probably, you know, be retching the next morning because, like, the curse was slowly eating away his innards.
Right.
So... In 5e, I don't think he would necessarily be one of the strongest builds, but I think this would be a ton of fun. And that's Devotion Paladin 6, Archfey Warlock 11, Storm Sorcerer 3. Part of those selections are just to tie into the backstory that he had and the way that he was sort of represented in fourth edition. But with this particular build, you get this nice smite cycle where, you know, you can use the sorcery points. And then, of course, you've got your warlock spell slots that you can continually feed into your smites.
Right.
And then you've also got a nice fair number of invocations from warlock. And I really like the flavor of warlock. Also, you know, he had this gesh on him, so he was always looking for ways to wriggle out from under it. So I definitely see him making a pact with somebody. And Archfey gives you lots of options for teleportation. Storm Sorcerer also makes you super mobile as well. You know, drop a little bit of lightning magic and then you can fly those
fly 10 feet,
right? Yeah. Without taking any opportunity attacks. Mm-hmm. And then Devotion Paladin, he was in 4E, he was a defender. So of course he's throwing himself in the way of arrows to protect people that he just hated.
So protection fighting style for that Paladin. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Shane, I think I know the answer, but what's your favorite build?
Well, this is the 5e build that I played the longest. This is Bran Talandro, the Silver Flame Inquisitor.
He was really good.
I was really happy with the way he played. And I was on the fence about a couple things. I'll talk about that in a bit. But so we're telling the story of Bran. He was an Inquisitor of the Silver Flame. His background was as a spy. So the criminal background. He had that sort of very useful talking skill set. He had good knowledge. He was technically devout as a cleric, but lots of his powers were dedicated towards being a better inquisitor, and the best way for me to represent that was with a sorcerer. And being as deities in Eberron were not living and active and, you know, participants in the lives of their devotees, mm-hmm. It seemed to work fine that he was an arcane caster instead of a divine one. So he's a half-elf criminal spy. Rogue 1, Knowledge Cleric 1, Dragon Sorcerer 18.
So all the knowledges.
I took all the proficiencies I could find for as little cost as possible. Yeah.
I will say there was never anything that I threw at you guys that Brand didn't have some sort of answer for.
Yeah, he was a little bit limited in the crowd control sort of utility areas of combat. You know,
he had Scorching Ray.
Yeah,
so I'll hit 5 people.
Right, that was his thing, was just throw more damage at it. Mm-hmm. He didn't really have a lot of other kind of control things, right? He had polymorph,
he'd run away.
He was very good at running away and very good at defending himself.
Yes.
But he had haste and polymorph, which are two of the most powerful twin spells, mm-hmm. right? Because you can hit 2 targets. And so he had a thing for a while where he turned his allies into T-Rexes.
Yeah, he did do that.
And at one point, I had to turn myself into a T-Rex to boost my con saves.
See, that's one thing that I really liked about him is he was very pragmatic in the way that he used his abilities and inventive, right? Okay, why would you want to turn yourself into a T-Rex? Oh, obviously to like eat something huge or scare people or for combat, right?
Right.
Nope, I just want survivability. That's what I'm looking for right now. What will do that? T-Rex.
Right, and that was very much his ethos, right? Was no matter what he does, he cannot accomplish his goals unless he lives. So he invested very heavily in defending himself. So item-wise, I was always trying to look for the highest AC. That's why I took the Dragon Sorcerer in the first place, was to get the base AC of 13 and then plus dex. He learned how to use a shield and got Warcaster in order to do that. He learned the shield spell and channeled all of his slots into shield whenever possible. Right? I mean, it was... And then he had the... You know, his biggest threats would be spells. So he had counterspell. And that was the other thing he always saved slots for, was the ability to counterspell. He never took his reaction for anything else.
Mm-hmm. And as a story reward, I eventually gave you guys one of the blessings from the DMG. And of course, he took magic resistance.
Yeah.
And then... Oh, and before that, he made a pact, of course. And got magic resistance.
Yeah.
It was familiar.
Yeah, I made a pact with the devil. But that build comes with 4 expertises. So I felt that I could get the deception and persuasion from rogue, and then I got knowledge and religion and history from knowledge cleric. Flavorful either way, right? And I also got a sweet bless spell, which is one of the most useful level 1 spells, and the awesome guidance and resistance cantrips, mm-hmm. from knowledge cleric. So
yeah, a bunch of you guys had those, so always someone was casting those.
Right, right.
Anytime, I'm going to the library. Oh, I'm going to go with you so I can cast guidance the whole time.
Unfortunately, we spent a lot of time with dragons towards the higher end of the campaign. So right. I was working with expertise. I had advantage. I had guidance. And then I also had the reliable talent for that I ended up with somehow, maybe.
The dragon sorcerer makes you more persuasive when you're talking to dragons.
Something like that, right. Yeah. I think that's how I got advantage. The mechanical, right? Yeah, but, you know, so dealing with it with dragons, it was great. And that was my whole thing, right? Like, I kind of had dragon blood in me. I thought I was special because of that.
Also, your first magic item pickup, as soon as it appeared, you snagged a headband of intellect.
Right.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you have intelligence 19?
Well, eventually I got simulacrum. Right. And I made a simulacrum of myself and gave him my headband of intellect.
So you were the combat version, and the smart version was like, stay back there and don't get hurt.
Yeah, exactly. Don't turn back to ice.
Right. You cost a lot.
Yeah.
And of course, it being you said, yeah, it's a good idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. I'll just be over here with shield spell. Right.
All right. So my second build is really just for fun. I think it would be a blast to play. I think lots of times we say we're going to go with a caster, right? Because magic is very versatile. It's very powerful. But I have always had this strong penchant for martial characters who don't really use very much magic or any magic at all, partly because lots of times they're just the underdog.
Yeah. I think that's why you liked 4E a lot.
I liked it at the beginning. I liked that, you know, it really smoothed out the power discrepancies.
Right, right.
And then after a while, I was like, okay, but it's a little restricting.
Yeah.
You know, so I was happy to hop back into 5e. But yeah, I still definitely have this soft spot in my heart for martial and particularly melee characters. But one of the bad parts in older editions was that they just didn't have anything to do, right? I hit it and then I hit it again.
Yeah, I roll 4 dice this time instead of 2.
Right. And then 3-5, it was like, and the last 3 don't matter because I'm not going to hit with them.
Right, right.
Yeah. Or they don't matter because I'm always going to hit with them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But 5e, there's just so many options and so many ways to get really cool abilities. So I think this is a really fun spread. And that's Fighter 12, Monk 3, Barbarian 3, Rogue 2. Now, Fighter 12 is there to get you 3 base attacks, which I love. That's a nice bit of damage output. But you also get all the other fighter goodies. And of course, you can go Battlemaster Fighter, which gives you so many different options on your hit. You could also go Eldritch Knight if you want.
And get some light spells.
Mm-hmm. Monk 3, again, I would say probably open hand, because when you flurry, you get, you know, all those different abilities for push or prone.
See, I still disagree that Monk 3 is good here, because either you can't use a two-handed weapon, you can't use a shield, and you've only got 3 key points, so you're so limited in what you're going to be able to do. You're asking the party to rest after every fight, and like, sorry, dude, if you're the fighter, get up, lead the way.
But you don't have to flurry with those key points, right? You got 3 base attacks to begin with. And remember, with Monk 1, you can make 1 attack as a bonus action. So you could just be rocking 4 attacks every round.
Well, but you got to have an empty hand to do that.
And no armor, yeah.
So, I mean,
this is fun, not necessarily the most effective.
It's
the other thing I would say
it's very conditional on all regards, right?
Well, no, not really, because you got 12 levels of fighter. You could just fight all day.
You should just fight all day.
Nah, because the other option is Sun Soul Monk, right? You can use those key points for fire.
For fireballs.
Super cool, yeah.
I like that better instantly.
Yeah. And then Barbarian 3 is obviously for Bear Totem. But also, you know, you can rage a couple times a day, which gives you a lot of neat, interesting options. And then it makes you a lot tougher, at least a few times a day. And then Rogue 2, because honestly, yes, expertise, that's fine, that's good. This build has a lot of skills, but really it's for cunning action, just because it makes you super fast. If you want to double dash, you can double dash and no one's going to catch you, or you're always going to catch other people. It makes chase scenes, yeah, you're the person who wins the chase scenes. And I like that. I think it's fun.
So what would you call this build?
a non-magical bard. A jack of all trades, but no magic. Because I also could have just gone Bard 20.
Right. All right. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you're willing to help us out with a 5-star review, we'll read it on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. And if you like us or favorite us, the algorithm will help other people find us as well.
So we do have a 5-star review from iTunes today. It's called Great RPG Podcast, 5 stars by Harris293. Enjoying the podcast. Much more interesting and informative than listening to a group D&D session. I look forward to the new episode each week, saving it for when I have time to pay attention and really listen.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Thank you for the compliment. So what do we have planned for next week's episode, Ishan?
We're saying goodbye to 2015 with the first annual Thrilly Awards, a list of our favorite RPGs, supplements, and products from the past year. We'll also be sharing our New Year's gaming resolutions.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We'll be building the Sentinel.
Well, that's it for episode 22 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.